increases its diameter, it is considerably more difficult for it to maintain nutrition in the center of the fiber. As it continues to increase its size, it must increase its membrane surface to volume ratio, and it will start to invaginate and ultimately split. And I think this splitting leads to some of the findings that will give the increased jitter that Dave was seeing in his single fiber studies.
Actually, I can comment directly on that. You can detect a split fiber very simply on single fiber EMG. It is very characteristic because when you get the single fiber electrode between two fibers that are split or between the two branches of a split fiber, there is no jitter. In other words, they both receive the impulse from the same end plate. The fiber is in the shape of a Y, and you get your recording electrode between the Y, so that there is essentially no jitter occurring, and you know immediately that you're dealing with a split fiber, and you record these very commonly in myopathies.
Let me mention the way that this was done. There's a very simple way of doing it. You put a person on a bike and you have them pedal as hard as they possibly can with increasing force, and the faster that they pedal, the less force of contraction that they can generate. And then as you turn up the resistance, they pedal slower until the point where they cannot pedal at all, and then they have a mechanical device to turn the wheel of the bike, and the person forces the pedal so that they have to resist the motor turning the pedal around, and at that moment in time, the force of contraction increases. So this is done in a very physiologic manner that is not physiologic, a very gross matter, not done in the highly sophisticated single fiber studies that you were talking about before, Bob. All right, in any event, you have at least my hypothesis. Now, in order to evaluate some of these factors, we took a look at synergistic tenotomy, swimming, and electrical stimulation, among a lot of other studies that I'm not going to report on because it'll take all day. Let's take a look at the first experiment that we embarked on. Next slide. What we did was evaluate three groups of muscles. I mean, three groups of animals. We have already determined that reinnervation in the rat begins at about 2 weeks after crush denervation. All right, so that there's a paucity of motor units at approximately 2 weeks after crush denervation. It's obvious that there would be more motor units active 3 weeks after crush denervation because of the fact that there is very rapid reinnervation in the rat soleus muscle. Then what we did was perform synergistic tenotomy 2 weeks after crush denervation in group two and 3 weeks after denervation in group three. So one group was overworked for 2 weeks and another group was overworked for 1 week. The one group, pardon me? I beg your pardon. Next slide. You see, I knew you were going to be here, Fred, so I brought this along. Anyway, what I did was cut the plantaris and the gastrocnemius on one side of the animal, and on the other side of the animal, we cut the gastroc and the soleus, so that we removed approximately 85% of the plantar flexures of the muscles as a consequence of cutting the tendons, these two major tendons of the plantar flexures. Now, this, as you can well imagine, is an extreme form of overwork that continues all day long. All right? Does that answer your question? Okay. Are there any other questions about the method of overwork? Okay. Next slide. We then evaluated the sarcoplasmic protein, which is just a catch-all for all sarcoplasm. It's got all of the enzymes. There's not one specific enzyme that we're looking at. I don't want you to particularly focus on the sarcoplasm. I want you to take a look at the contractile proteins, the myofibrillar proteins in the group 1 and the group 2. Now, you recall that the group 2 included those animals that began exercising when there were a paucity of motor units present. In other words, the group two were exercised 2 weeks after crushed denervation, at the very earliest phase of reinnervation, while the group one was exercised between 3 weeks after denervation, and the experiment was terminated at 4 weeks of denervation. And how would you interpret that, Dr. Dalakis? A line going up, anything that goes up is goodness and anything going down is badness.
Well, you have to explain the slide first before I don't understand the slide very well.
All right.
You mean there's increased proteins in
Go ahead.
Increased proteins in the animals that they exercise more?
There was increased protein in the group that was exercised when, in our opinion, there were more motor units. Because at 3 weeks after crushed denervation, reinnervation was more complete. Mm-hmm. Do you follow that?
Yeah.
At 2 weeks, we initiated exercise when reinnervation was just in its infant stages, if you will, so the number of motor units were fewer.
So you mean there is these muscle fibers are leaking? Are leaking? The membrane is more unstable, so they leak. Is that?
I'm not making an interpretation of exactly what happens, but the way I interpreted this is that when there are too few motor units participating, the myofibrillar protein decreases from the control level. While if there is an increased number of motor units participating, then there is an increase in contractile proteins. So the way I interpreted this, that was in the absence of sufficient motor units, overactivity caused some form of damage. Now, you can argue with that. I'm sure that there are opportunities for comment. Yes?
The reverse too. That if you wait for reinnervation to take place, you'll get a hypertrophy of muscle. Is that what's not showing as well, or am I misinterpreting your result?
The question is, would I end up with a hypertrophy of muscle if I waited for more reinnervation to occur? And that indeed does happen. For instance, if you do this to totally normal muscle, you end up with marked hypertrophy, okay? But I wasn't totally satisfied, and the reason why I wasn't totally satisfied with my experimental model is because this is a very artificial system whereby you cut tendons and overwork muscles by synergistic tenotomy. So what I decided to do was crush the sciatic nerve and have the animals swim, all right, rather than have them overworked by synergistic tenotomy. Next slide. And what we found was this. First of all, let me explain the slide to you. In one group of animals, we exercised them from 3 to 6 weeks after denervation, crushed denervation, and in another group from 4 to 6 weeks. In other words, we took it the next step. We anticipated that if we went further along, we'd have even more innervation. And it was complete. We conducted above the crush, and we could not conduct across the crush. We didn't transect it. We crushed it 10 times with a flat-tipped hemostat.
And what does it induce?
It induces fibrillations and no conduction across the block.
And these can recover? I mean, this crush recovers?
They recover so fast, and you'll see what I did because of the fact that they recover so fast. They recover so fast, as a matter of fact, that it really doesn't mimic the polio patient. They're just so rapid, I had to turn to a different model, which you'll see in a second. Okay? Yes, Ken. Just a second.
Could you stimulate below the block and get a response? In other words, Parsons from Denver, were you inducing a neuropraxic injury or an axonal degeneration injury?
The question is whether or not I produced a neuropraxic block. And the answer to that is that 3 days after crushing the sciatic nerve, I conducted below the level of the block, and there was no conduction. So that there was I had proved that there was Wallerian degeneration, so that the way that recovery occurred was by true neuronal regrowth. All right? But it occurs, as I said, reinnervation under this set of circumstances occurs almost totally in 4 to 6 weeks, so that it's an extremely rapid process. All right? In any event, you can see that there is a trend such that when we began the exercise, when there were more motor units, there was indeed a greater amount of muscle protein. So that also helped us to confirm, to some extent, that equation that I showed you before, that if the number of motor units is sufficient, then there is little likelihood of damage. All right?
Jerry,
but yes.
May I raise a question? Do we have control studies of animals that are not exercised to see what happens to their protein levels?
Oh, that's the control level. You see, that's percent over control. I'm sorry, I should have. This is a percent over control. This bait. The control is denervated, crush, just plain old crush.
With no exercise.
With nothing. All right. The question is if you just cut the tendon, you have a tremendous increase in protein. As a matter of fact, Goldberg has done this any number of times at Hopkins. I'll show you some slides of that, too. We've done that. Jackie,
what's
did you?
The answer? Yes or no?
Oh, the answer is that you do end up with a tremendous increase in protein when you take normal rats and you cut the tendon. The protein goes up, which of course fits because then you have a total complement of motor units. Questions? Could somebody pour me a glass of water there?
Right here.
All right. Next slide now. We, yes.
Where do these proteins come from?
Pardon me?
Where do these proteins come from? What kind of protein is this? This is myosin,
the myofibrillar protein.
And this is...
contractile protein.
How do you explain the amount of protein which has been released there?
The question is, how do you explain the increase in protein? And nobody can explain that as yet. We know what happens. As a matter of fact, Ben Saltine, I thought he'd be here this morning, he says that probably the major advances in muscle physiology is in answering the question of why these changes occur. All we are now doing is describing that they do occur. I'm going to tell you some of the things that I'm going to do in the future to try to answer this question, and knowing that I have brilliant minds like you around, I hope to tap your expertise to make my job easier. In any event, next slide. All right. I did not like our experiment, and the reason why I did not like the experiment is because it did not mimic polio, and because of my own background, I wanted to mimic polio to some extent. Not only that, I wanted to mimic spinal cord injury patients because of the fact that there's a multiplicity of spinal cord injury centers throughout the country, and in those centers, you do not have crush denervation, you have partial denervation in the classic sense. So it seemed to me more reasonable to turn to those entities that were what we see under ordinary circumstances at the present time. So what I did was take a sciatic nerve and take out 70% of the sciatic nerve. Do you follow that? I attempted to cut out 70% of the nerve. And I had 3 groups and 5 rats per group. And then in a second series of animals, we had normal, they were normal animals, there were 3 groups of animals, and again, 5 rats per group. Next slide. We implanted electrodes. This is what Dave was talking about before. What we did was take these little electrodes and solder them onto these hook and eyes down to this end down here. You can see there's one continuous electrode. One would be the cathode and one would be the anode. Next slide. Then what we did was suture that to a plastic tube. And then the next thing that we did, Dave, stand up here a second. What we did was slit the rat right here. And don't forget, the wires are attached like so. And we stuck that tube subcutaneously down to the sciatic notch, all right, and then sutured that little patch to the back in order to perform chronic stimulation. Next slide. Thanks, Steve. He's already jumping there. It worked, by God.
It proves the whole thing,
right. Then we implanted the electrodes next to the nerve. Now, I want to make a point here that is important. I am not stimulating the muscle directly. I am not doing the old-fashioned stimulation, Dr. Knapp, in the polio days where you took a totally denervated muscle and stimulated the muscle directly. We are stimulating the nerve. Now, Walt, in the past, you asked me whether or not there was any overflow to the muscle. We checked that very critically to make sure that the current at the level of the sciatic notch was solely stimulating the nerve. There was no overflow to the muscle. Okay? Now the question is, how did we know that? We cut the sciatic nerve completely, put the electrodes in the same place, and found that we had absolutely no evidence of muscle contraction. Therefore, we know that every bit of muscle contraction that took place was done as a result of stimulating the nerve. Okay, next slide. This is the electrode hooked up to the patch on the back. You can see the denervation has occurred down here. The wire electrodes are traveling subcutaneously to where they're adjacent to the sciatic nerve. All right, next slide. And these are the rats being stimulated. What we had to do was put wire shields around the electrodes because the rats would chew the wires off because they didn't find that this treatment was altogether to their liking. Next slide. We gave extremely low amperage pulses, 2 to 4 milliamps, and at 10 hertz. Now, is 10 hertz enough to cause a tetanic contraction? No, it's not. In animals, you have to get up to at least 20. In slow twitch muscle and more 40 to 50 in fast twitch muscle. All right? So we were subtetanic. We stimulated the animals 2, 4, and 8 hours per day, 5 days per week for 6 weeks. All right? You see that? Next slide.
Did they eat?
They ate. Gained
they gained
weight.
Your three groups, subgroups were the 2, 4, and 8?
Here it is here. 30 rats. And these are the groups. These are the rat groups, and these are the hours stimulated per day. So we had 15 normals and 15 70% partial denervated animals, and we stimulated each of them 2, 4, and 8 hours a day, an extremely long period of time, which of course you couldn't do unless you had implants. All right? Next slide. Well, what we found is the following. What you see on the ordinate here is the weight of the soleus muscle. This is the weight of the soleus muscle. This bottom part of the diagram that you see is a result of stimulating the normal muscle. This is as a result of stimulating the denervated muscle. The white blocks are controls, so this is a normal control, this is a normal control, this is a normal control. This is a 70% denervated control, 70% denervated control, and 70% denervated control. Now, let's see here. How would you interpret that?
Here you go.
Better ask somebody else.
Pardon me?
I'm just looking at it. Let me look at it for a moment before saying.
That's all right. I think that one of the reasons why I do this is because it slows people down enough to understand what's going on. Sometimes what happens with...
Yes. So, were they sham stimulated or what?
You see, that the control groups had the electrodes in them, but they were not stimulated. Do you follow that? This is the other leg, Walt. Okay? This is the other leg on our animal. We were not stimulating bilaterally. Does everybody understand that? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Now, does that help?
What does ES stand
for? The ES refers to electrical stimulation for 8 hours, electrical stimulation for 4 hours, and electrical stimulation for 2 hours. These are all the normals. 2 hours of electrical stimulation, red is 4 hours of electrical stimulation, green is 8 hours of electrical stimulation. This is fairly intriguing, to be honest with you. Yes, let me give you this.
I'll volunteer an interpretation.
Okay.
Maynard, it looks like that in the normal animals that never had a sciatic nerve injury, that the electrical stimulation did not produce any noticeable change in the muscle weight, whereas in the ones that had the sciatic nerve injury, that you got progressively more, you got hypertrophy, or at least an increase in weight, with electrical stimulation, and somewhat greater with 8 hours per day than two.
Anybody have any other interpretations?
Yes.
Let me just... I'm going to stop here for a second because I wonder whether or not Dr. Bodian has an interpretation. There's one that he might know of that nobody else in the room might.
I don't know it.
You don't know it. You will in a second. I'll bet you will remember. You remember, you forgot more than I'll ever know.
Before I'm so bold as to guess, Jerry, I want to ask you if when you do these nerve sections, you do them in such a way as to be sure that you denervate one group of muscles over another. In other words, it's the probably topographic localization of axons in the sciatic nerve in the rats like there are in humans with the perineal division, tibial division, and so forth. It looks like in your control, I'm going to go on the assumption that all of the nerve injuries were exactly the same. It looks like in your denervated or partially denervated groups, the degree of atrophy that you produced was somewhat retarded by electrical stimulation. But in both the stimulated and non-stimulated denervated muscles, the weight is less than it is in normals. That's not quite the same as hypertrophy. It's just retarded atrophy.
It's retarded atrophy, but I want to make sure that you understand that we were not stimulating the denervated muscle. In other words, what you're seeing is not a consequence of stimulating denervated muscle to prevent atrophy. I'm trying to find out whether or not somebody else has an explanation as to why they think that there's an increased weight in those activated muscles.
Okay, we have increased weight of muscle due to stimulus of a nerve going down through the motor end plate to the muscle. Okay, and the weight is increased. On your P less than 0.05, three different colors. Does that mean that within that group only, in other words, at the 2 hour level, the stimulated group more than the control P less than 0.05 difference? Okay, so you have internally regulated parameters as far as saying that at 2 hours it's a significant difference, at 4 hours it's a significant difference, at 8 hours it's a significant difference. Now, to me, what I think is interesting is that you don't see a 2 hour to 4 hour increase of, let's say, 50%. And then a 4 hour to 8 hour increase of another 50% beyond that. In other words, it's the first two were about level, and then up at 8 hours, it's only a little bit higher. To me, I would wonder, is that indicative of going through the motor end plate? You can only go so high, so much magnitude, and then no further.
That's right. So that there's an identical response independent of whether or not they're stimulated 2, 4, 8 hours. But I wonder again whether or not there's an explanation. I'm going to go back here just for a second. Okay.
Well, I'm totally guessing because I don't deal with patients in this state, rats or otherwise. but could it mean that the increased size or weight of those muscles that are being stimulated at greater periods each day is in fact resulting in the reinnervation of more muscle fibers over that period. Is stimulation producing further reinnervation and therefore activity and recovery of greater numbers of muscle fibers?
The reason why I went to Dr. Tomlinson was because of the fact that he mentioned a very interesting experiment yesterday, which very simply stated that with increased activity, there was much less of a reduction in arborization in the central nervous system. Could a similar process be occurring in the peripheral nervous system? This is what intrigues me about this, and I'll come back to this. I'm sorry, Dick.
I was just going to say, conceivably, part of that could be some muscle fiber hypertrophy, and also, are you speculating that this is a sprouting effect?
I did not think it was muscle fiber hypertrophy, and the reason for that was I didn't see any evidence of hypertrophy in the normal. That's always the reason why we do a normal group.
I think you had a question too, right?
Yeah.
First of all, did you stimulate continuously or you had an interrupter in the stimulation?
I want to continue.
The question was whether or not that 2 hours of stimulation was continuous and 4 hours continuous and 8 hours continuous, and the answer is to that is it was interrupted, obviously, but not for hours between.
Now, may I be bold enough to say that this is not an adequate stimulation of the nerves, because everybody knows that if you stimulate the nerves in a normal individual, you increase its bulk by at least 30% with this regimen. So your stimulation of the nerve for some reason was inadequate. Why? First of all, why did you use 4 millisecond duration? If you stimulate the nerves, you should have used at a half a millisecond maximum, maybe 1/10 of a millisecond.
I can always bank on Dr. Lieberson bringing this up. Because I was cheap and that's the only thing I had available. If I wasn't so damn cheap, I would have bought one that would give me a 50 microsecond pulse. I'm sorry.
Right. McComas, you've given us a real puzzle here. It seems to me that you may be producing hypertrophy of the stimulated fibers, but also that you may be retarding atrophy in the denervated fibers by virtue of the fact that these muscles will be passively stretched at certain points along their length by the contraction of the innervated fibers.
There was another interesting phenomena that we found, and that was that the axons hypertrophied in addition to the muscle fibers. But that's a different study, and I got to repeat that. And the reason why I have to repeat it is because I don't feel totally secure with our results. Yes?
Didn't you also say that this was the rat, and you said at 6 to 8 weeks, didn't the nerve that you've already cut regenerate?
Oh, you're beautiful. May I give you a handshake? That was the problem with this experiment. Dr. Albus hit the nail right square on the head. I didn't like this experiment because of the fact that I found out that you could splice, you could take a half an inch of nerve, sciatic nerve, out of a rat, splice it with a piece of skin, and end up with 100% reinnervation. Thus, again, I had ended up utilizing a model that I didn't like, which takes me to the next experiment.
If you would like to,
go ahead. I'll go ahead. All right. Let me just show you what happened to the tetanic tensions as well. Next slide. Interestingly, you can see that when we stimulated the muscle tetanically in a bath, the way Bob Taylor was so kind to show us exactly how to perform beautiful stimulation techniques and keeping our muscles warm and giving field stimulation. Without his assistance, I could not have done this experiment. So I am indebted to him for this. Now, what we did, of course, the experiment was identical to what I described before, except in this situation, we measured tetanic tension. And notice that the results are identical to what you found in the muscle weight, so that our force of contraction also increased with 2, 4, and 8 hours of very modest stimulation. Okay? But because of the fact that I didn't like the experimental model for the exact reason that Dr. Alba mentioned, I went on to another one. Would you like to comment?
Why couldn't you have tied off the end of the fiber that you cut out in such a way that it couldn't have regenerated?
The question is, why didn't we tie off that nerve? And the reason for that is, even when we tied it off, the nerve found its way back down to the muscle. So therefore, I wanted to find a model that would do exactly what Dave Weekers described before. That is to say, give us a model that we could study the upside of reinnervation, the plateau period, like most of us are talking about, and then the aging phenomena. I had to develop a model where I was sure there was no reinnervation, because that's the polio model. That, in many instances, is the kind of model that we have with spinal cord injured patients and so on. Next slide. Oh, I beg your pardon. I forgot to give one. Yep, no, that's it. I want that one. After performing this experiment, as so often happens, I went back and read an absolutely marvelous review of reinnervation by Brown in Physiologic Reviews. And interestingly enough, he referred back to Hoffman, who performed experiments in Australia in 1982. What he did was perform an L5 section. He stimulated the muscles with 1.5 milliamps current for 10 to 60 minutes a day for 1 to 4 days. And then he evaluated the number of sprouts. Now, I can go into how you do that afterwards, and I bet you know a heck of a lot more about how to evaluate peripheral sprouts than I do, but it's a very tricky technique. What he found was that there was an increase in sprouting with chronic electrical stimulation. In other words, he stimulated sprouting with chronic electrical stimulation. That's relevant because it may well be, as we've indicated before, that with aging, there is less activity, and with less activity, there's a reduction in the number of sprouts, and with this chronic stimulation, it may well be that there is a maintenance of sprouts. That hasn't been shown. Don't forget, I'm looking at the upside here. I'm looking at the reinnervation side. We have to look at it at the other end of the spectrum, like we have the opportunity to do with all of our polio patients if we so choose. Next slide. As I said, I was somewhat dissatisfied with my model. So what I did was take a hemostat, incise the rat in the flank, take a hemostat up to the L5 root and pull it right out of the spinal cord. Now, that worked pretty well for the purpose of producing permanent denervation. There was very little likelihood of reinnervation after the anterior horn cells are gone. Then we did the following. Next slide. This is an L5, you can see it. We pulled out the L5. We had one control group, and we had one group in which we performed that bilateral synergistic tenotomy. You remember that I mentioned before, where we cut the gastroc and the plantaris. And then we ran one group at an 8% grade, and we ran another group at a 35% grade. Next slide. So 10 days after pulling L5, this is just about at the time that peripheral sprouts become functional in rats. Just about the time, all right? And the treadmill was set at 20 kilometers per hour. They ran 1 hour a day for 5 days a week. Now, the reason why we picked this is not too far-fetched. There's a lot of people that run an hour a day. So it's pretty close to joggers at the present time. A lot of joggers run a half hour a day, but there are some that run a full hour a day. Then we sacrifice the animals 2 weeks later. That is to say, 24 days after the L5 was pulled. And then we evaluated fiber areas. Now, why did we evaluate fiber areas, Walt? What was my original hypothesis? My original hypothesis was that when we took a look at Drachman's work, there was evidence of fibronecrosis, centralized nuclei, Z-line streaming, wide variation in fiber size and so on. Why did we evaluate this? Why didn't we turn to tensions or whatever?
I can't see inside your brain.
Well, I'll bet there are some that could, based on what have we sort of been building a little bit of a case for? We've been building a little bit of a case for an inhibition of reinnervation with overactivity. Is there any takers on what we were looking for? Bob?
Well, you also are looking for a working for the model of muscle damage to the individual fibers from the overwork hypertrophy.
From the overwork hypertrophy, but I'm sort of building a case for something else now. As time has evolved in the talk, there's something else that begins to meet the mind. Yes?
Yeah, question. Is the L5 rut responsible for innervation to the soleus?
Oh, yes. The L5 supplies 80% of the soleus. I should have mentioned that. I'm glad. Yeah.
And how do you know you had the L5 root?
We know that we had the L5 root because when we stimulated, we produced plantar flexion, and then we did cross-sections of the soleus nerve and found that there was 80% denervation. Okay. Other questions about technique? It's important. I'm glad that you asked me about technique because technique is critical. Interpretation doesn't mean anything unless our methodology is any good. Okay. Let's take a look and see what's happened. Next slide. Now, in this, don't darken the slide, the lights. In this, what you're looking at is the number of fibers. This is the percent of fibers with fiber areas of 800, 1600, 2400, 3200 microns. And that's the control range is the hashed group, and the solid bar is the tenotomized group. So you're looking at percents of fibers in these ranges. Ernie, what do you notice? But don't forget, this isn't a tenotomized. Notice that the solid lines refer to synergistic tenotomy. The dashed lines are the controls. Controls, I don't mean normal controls. I mean pulling out L5 controls. Yes?
Ken.
A shift towards smaller diameter fibers. And what does that mean to you, Ken?
That the overwork has somehow selected for smaller diameter fibers.
And what might have it done? What might have it done, that overwork? Pardon me? I'm not so sure. Decreased circulation. I'm beginning to wonder, Jackie, whether or not what we've done is inhibit reinnervation with this tenotomy. Tenotomy is, again, going overboard with activity. And have we done something, as Dave was talking about yesterday, to inhibit peripheral sprouting? Is indeed this one of the phenomena that occurs in old polios, if these old polios are overworked, do we have an insufficient metabolism of the neurons to support the muscle fibers and therefore have progressive denervation? Next slide. Next slide after that. I found exactly the same thing with the 35% grade running and the 8% grade running, so I'm not going to pursue that. But what I want to do is show you the muscle fibers themselves. Okay? I want to show you the muscle fibers. Let's see here. Alan, do you want to interpret those?
But what's your treadmill running rate really 20 kilometers an hour?
Yes.
But that's a sort of marathon.
Well, it's a marathon. It's vigorous.
Well, rats can't run at that speed.
Ours did.
I'm sure they didn't slide. Of course, after a while, they just give up and get carried back by the treadmill and just lie against the stop.
We were pretty intent on getting them to run. 20 is what we usually use.
Yeah, but for a human, that's world record speed. Anyway, that's a small point. I haven't taken in the slide yet, so ask someone else.
Okay, you're still meditating on it, and I take your criticism, and I will... Oh, let me ask you a different question. What speed would you run them at?
I Well, something very much lower than that. I haven't actually run rats, but I've seen other rats on treadmills, and you know, the rates are certainly an order of magnitude less than that.
Okay. Bob, do you want to interpret those slides? You've seen a lot of slides.
The thing that amazes me on the non-scientific one, the electric one on both sides, is that it looks to be driven by the rat, and we expect to see the intervention from the whole group.
This is soleus now, so you wouldn't really see group fiber. Actually, what I'm pointing out is, do you see wide variation in fiber size and muscle fiber necrosis or anything of that sort?
What kind of stain is this?
This is a, let me see, let me get my signal straight on this. This is an ATPase at 9.
The top one.
At the top one. That's
9.4.
That's 9.4.
Which is the ATPase, the top one?
Top one is ATPase
9.4. The bottom,
one is a Polaroid.
No, that's mislabeled. The top one has to be 4.6. ATPase of 4.6 because it's the soleus.
And what's the bottom one?
And the bottom one is the ATPase at 9.4.
So we see the fibers are reversed then?
The fibers are reversed.
So they're not comparable?
They're comparable in the sense that the
whatever is white on the bottom is should be dark on the top.
That's right. No, the bottom half is 9.4 and the top half is 4.6. So as you know, you have a reversal of staining.
Right. So whatever is dark on the top will be white on the bottom.
That's right. That's right. Now, the question I ask is whether or not you see any evidence of a myopathic transformation occurring.
No, on the top there's no myopathy, but this is not the right stain to see if there are myopathic changes. You should have a trichrome or...
Should have a trichrome.
Yeah,
but you see variation in fiber size.
Definitely, absolutely. Yeah, it's a small area to see if there is significant grouping, but there is, at least at the top, there is grouping of one fiber type. I see very few of the other types. Is that right?
Well, in the soleus, only 20% are type 2A fibers.
Yeah, I don't know.
So you don't really have that.
Okay. But I don't see signs of myopathy.
You don't see signs of myopathy. That's the main point that I want to bring out with this, so that the hypothesis that I originally tried to develop really didn't pan out. I do not find evidence of direct muscle fiber damage. What I'm finding evidence of, more than anything, is an inhibition of reinnervation rather than actual damage to the muscle fibers. All right?
Jerry, this is
splitting. Pardon me?
Is this splitting?
I see very little splitting in these. Very little splitting. Yes, Jackie?
Why is a small fiber identified decreased? Why does the small fiber size as a result indicate decreased innervation? You have it active fibers. I don't understand the reason of your interpretation.
The question is, why is it that the small fibers are...
You said it's a lack of sprouting. I don't know how you put those two together.
The question is, how can I interpret from looking at this side, slide, that there's a lack of sprouting? The only way that I can interpret a lack of sprouting is by actually doing the fiber counts that I did before. Don't forget, this is just a small section of the entire muscle. But what impressed me more than anything, Jackie, was that I did not find evidence of myopathy. By the way, we did trichrome stains on this, and there was absolutely no evidence of myopathy changes.
Maybe I missed your point.
Yeah.
I don't know what, if you have found changes of myopathy, what this would have told you.
Oh, the question is, what would it have told me if I found evidence of a myopathy?
Now, this is, we know that if you have severe chronic neurogenic changes, the changes become identical to myopathic changes sometimes.
That's right.
In a chronic, severe neuropathy.
This is the end of tape number 6. Please continue listening on tape 6B.